second of tonight's speakers, Lisa.
Thanks, Shelley. My name's Lisa and I'm an addict. When Charlie rang me up and said, would I come and do the share at this meeting? I said, you know, I'd love to. And he said, it's, you know, there's a few people there. It's, you know, quite a big meeting. He didn't say how big a meeting. I've never seen a meeting this size, apart from at a convention. It's amazing. I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. In fact, the first meeting I ever went to of NA was in the crypt here in St. Martin's of the Field. The meetings, I don't think, there any longer. And this was 30 years ago now, and which is in itself is extraordinary. You know, the fact I haven't picked up a drug or a drink for that long is just still, to me, something that I can't really comprehend. And I remember walking into that meeting, and there was only two NA meetings a week in London, and there was lots of AA, but I wasn't an alcoholic. I was a drug addict, as far as I was concerned. So I would not go to AA. And I walked into this meeting. There was probably about 8 recovering addicts sitting there, and I knew by the end of the meeting, because for quite a few years I'd got to the point where I thought once a junkie, always a junkie, and I'd sort of become comfortable with that, and knew that I'd probably die a junkie, but in a way that was sort of safer than knowing that actually there was some kind of recovery. And by the end of this meeting, I knew that I could get better. And that was one of the most frightening things that I'll ever... Because my immediate thought was, I will be the only one in this room not to succeed. Because I was so used to failure. And I was so used to, I was completely used to failure. I mean, anything I touched just didn't, and also all my feelings up until then were very negative. And I'll never forget getting to the end of this meeting, and the guy who took me, who's still in the rooms today, said, Lisa, you know, there is a way out. You can get better. And I convinced myself that it would never work. But I went back to another meeting, the one that was just off the King's Road in Milner Street. And again, I identified with everything in the room. But again, it took me a few months because I was just so scared that, you know, that excuse had been taken away, once a junkie, always a junkie. I knew there was recovery. I knew it was out there. I knew it was possible. But I was convinced that yet again I would fail. And I finally ended up, I was fortunate enough, I ended up in a treatment centre in Weston-super-Mare. I tell you, I could never go back to that place. You know, any time in my recovery I've thought about relapse, I just have to think about Broadway Lodge, Totterdown Lane, Weston-super-Mare, and the halfway house I was in for about 4 months afterwards. It was a really a tough time for me then, because, you know, I was faced with myself for the first time in my life, and there was nothing about myself I liked, either physically or mentally. And I think that was probably one of the reasons that I started using drugs. I mean, I can never remember from an early age, I can never remember feeling good about myself. I always felt different. I always felt misunderstood. I always felt physically very unattractive. And And I didn't like my thoughts. I was very jealous. And I wasn't... my father's very competitive, and I was the sort of the opposite. And so anything I felt I couldn't do, I would just sort of retreat. And quite early on, I found that feeling of... I always felt empty. I don't know if anyone can understand that feeling of just really feeling empty. And for me, the first way to fill that void was food, which I discovered, you know, with food, it was legal and it was available and it was in practically every room in our house. And I got that feeling of comfort at a very early age. I could somehow numb those feelings. And I still... You know, I still have problem with that today. You know, my natural instinct 30 years later is if I can take away that feeling, whatever that feeling is, I will. Whether it's, you know, hiding my head under the duvet. I mean, I still, as much as I love the day, once I'm out of bed, getting me out of bed, having to face the day, My first thought is still fear. Fear of the day. You know, once I'm up, you know, I'm okay. But so I was always someone who was looking to change the way I felt, because it wasn't a good feeling the way I felt. So when I found drugs, when I was about 13, you know, I think the first thing was diet pills. Because the problem with the amount of food I was eating is I just got bigger and bigger. And diet pills were sort of really... I mean, I hated them because they made me very sort of speedy, but I liked the fact that it sort of stopped me eating. But I then needed something, obviously, to take away that sort of not being able to relax. And I guess by the time I was 15 or 16, I was in that cycle of... sort of smoking dope and diet pills and food and drink, anything really that would stop me feeling. And very quickly, I didn't do very well at school. I didn't pass, I say many exams, I didn't pass any exams. In those days it was O-levels. I was very dyslexic, which wasn't picked up, but that's not an excuse. I don't think I was ever really interested. And I had this real, real fear of failure. And for me, it was much easier just to play the class clown and not try, because then I had an excuse. You know, I could then say to myself, if I didn't pass exams, it's fine. You didn't try. And it's interesting because I have these wonderful 15-year-old twin boys, and one of them's just like me. You know, he's so capable, but he's got such fear of failure. You know, it's extraordinary. So, you know, I left school without any exams and went and worked at this. It was this fantastic new hamburger restaurant. It was the first hamburger, a proper American hamburger restaurant in London called the Great American Disaster. And I was the cashier there, and it was brilliant because, you know, all the guys there were taking hard drugs. I remember the first night I took heroin. I threw up and I threw up and I threw up and I threw up. Now, most normal people would think, you know, what is fun about being covered in a whole load of sick? I was just furious that this feeling that all these people around me seem to be having of this sort of, you know, slouched out in the corner of a room, totally relaxed, was not happening to me. And I remember I kept trying until I got that feeling. And from that moment on, there was no looking back. And I thought I had it made. You know, I had this great job as a cashier. I could shortchange anyone. I was really good at shortchanging. It was a time when all the Arabs had just arrived in London and didn't know the currency, and I was absolutely just... I was very good at what I did. Funny, it was really embarrassing. A few years ago, a cab driver recognised me and said, "Didn't you used to work at..." And I was with my husband at the Great American Disaster. Yeah. He said, "Yeah, I was the accountant." And I thought, oh, my God. he just sort of smiled. But, you know, and for a while, things were fine. You know, I was living away from home. I was working in this restaurant with loud music. I had enough money to buy the drugs I wanted to. And, of course, you know, I was never going to get a habit. You know, that happened to other people. But it wasn't going to happen to me because I was in control. And I loved the feeling of feeling nothing. I loved it. I loved just taking my drugs and just being able to numb out and feel that whatever does happen or doesn't happen, whatever is said or isn't said, everything's going to be okay. And I loved it. But very soon, I became physically, mentally, emotionally addicted. And what started off as a great way to numbing myself turned into a nightmare of overdoses, of doing everything and anything that I said I'd never do, using syringes, sleeping with dealers, doing anything and everything to get my drug of choice. My family didn't mean anything to me apart from my mother's handbag, if there was money in it. My sisters, who were younger than me and not into drugs and couldn't get me drugs, didn't know anything about drugs. I just ignored. My father I avoided. And I just went into this complete spiral very quickly. By the time I was 20, I was unemployable. But, you know, I still hadn't had enough. I think it wasn't until I started... It wasn't even the overdosing that did it. I remember there was a couple of times I overdosed and woke up to someone sort of, you know, pummeling my heart. And all I remember thinking was, that was a waste of money. I didn't feel the high that I needed to feel okay. And I remember, and I still remember today, you know, once getting stoned with a whole load of people and someone turning blue, and we just took them outside. Because in those days, I don't know if it's the same now, but if you called the ambulance, the police came too. And we didn't want the police around. And we didn't want anything that was going to interfere with us getting stoned. You know, I was just... It was the only thing that mattered to me. And I, you know, I got to the point where I just thought, you know, I'm in my 20s now. I did work. I held down jobs, but not for long. I always used to find jobs where there was a, you know, there was access to cash. So they never lasted that long. But I got to the point where I just thought, I'm not going to reach the age of 25. But, you know, I'm really, really lucky because I come from a really strong infrastructure. I come from a very close family. You know, friends. I still had some friends. I could still see that life was worth living. I just didn't know how to live it and feel at the same time. That was my problem. But I could see it was worth living. And I did want to live. And I not only did I want to live, I wanted to experience joy. You know, proper joy. And I got to the point where I was so fed up with, you know, because the drugs weren't working. You know, I got to the point where I was basically, you know, getting stoned to stay sane. You know, I wasn't getting that initial high. I wasn't getting that initial feeling. It was just horrible. It was really, really horrible. And boring. you know, the only interesting thing was going out and finding the drugs. And it was just boring. And, you know, I could see my sisters were getting on with their lives, and a couple of friends I still had were doing things. And, you know, one day I bumped into this friend of mine who I'd done a lot of using with, and he was clean, and he said, look, there is a way out. And as I said, you know, I ended up coming to this meeting, the one in the crypt, and I ended up going into treatment. And I remember this friend of mine taking me down on the train. There was so much smack in me. There were so many drugs in me. I don't know how I got into that treatment centre. And I hated it. Because, you know, they took away my drugs. And I'd sit there just eating packet after packet after packet after biscuits. Just biscuits, biscuits, biscuits. I just didn't want to feel. I just didn't know how to feel. And I ended up in this halfway house where I got to the point where I just thought, I can't do this. I can't do this. I cannot live without drugs. I cannot live having to feel like this 24/7. And I got ready to go back to London, and all I could think about was going back to my drug of choice. And luckily, you know, in the halfway house, there were 8 other women in early recovery, and they convinced me to stay. And it was there that for the first time in my life, I really asked for help. And since then, I haven't looked back. I guess I just handed it over. You know, for the first time, I really realised that actually doing it my way was not the only way. And look at where it got me. And I really started asking for help, and I started going to meetings, and I started talking about the way I felt. And that's sort of really what I've done throughout my recovery, is whatever's happened and whatever hasn't happened in my life, I've always come to meetings, and I've always tried to open my mouth and say how I feel. And I don't know how this fellowship works. I don't know how this program works. All I know is that it works. I've practiced the steps. I've been to step retreats. I've had sponsors. I haven't had sponsors. I met this girl the other day who sponsored me for years. I've completely forgotten. Completely forgotten. You know, my memory now has gone. I've sponsored. You know, I've done everything that has been suggested. Probably not. And I've done a lot of things that haven't been suggested. You know... I mean, in my first year in recovery, when I got back to London, the first job I got, I've always been a worker. You know, the fear of having to rely on someone else. You know, real control. I'm a real control freak. So I've always worked. I've always wanted to make my own money. And the first job I got was in this restaurant where a lot of friends of mine in recovery were working. Jervik probably remembers it, who was... been with me in recovery. In fact, we used together. And there was one night, Gervais with axes. So one of us had an axe, I can't remember. Someone who was with us had an axe, but I remember it was a very violent night. But it was both sitting here today, which is just fantastic. I got a job as a cashier, and I was about a year clean in this restaurant, full of people in recovery working. It was in Chelsea Wharf, I think, or somewhere around there near the river. And I remember thinking, I can't. And that cash till opened. The money was sitting there, and I couldn't resist. You know, because money for me was comfort, it was security, it was safety. It meant that just in case I needed to use, or just in case I needed to disappear, or just in case I needed to do this, I had some money in my back pocket. And it was about 6 months before the feelings got so bad, you know, the complete dishonesty, that I was able to share it at a meeting, and I left the job. I just knew, and even, I mean, I've been very, very lucky with work, and you know, I've had a lot of job satisfaction over the years. I've been lucky enough to have my own company and work with people that I've really wanted to work with, and do things that have brought me a lot of satisfaction. But you know, throughout all the years of having my own business, and this is my business, I don't go near the cash tin. I don't go near the petty cash. It's just, you know, it just, I don't know. I'm better now. But you know, probably because I've given the business up. But anyway, you know, I just, the only thing I haven't done in my recovery is pick up a drug or a drink. And that's the only thing I haven't done. And the one thing I've done throughout my recovery is come to meetings. And it hasn't been easy for me, and it's still not easy for me. Living in the day, living with my feelings, you know, I can't stand it if there's arguments, anything emotional between family or friends or anything. I don't like not knowing what's going to happen. You know, I'm a real control person. I look, you know, I sort of do something, I look to see what all the consequences might be. You know, I don't like not knowing what's going to happen. I mean, step three is a big one for me. You know, turning my will over is very tough for me. Step four and five were not that difficult for me, because I do believe this is an illness. I do believe that for me it's maybe part genetic, I don't know, but I do believe it's an illness. I know with my behaviour now, which is very obsessive, I'm all or nothing. If I work, I work 24/7. You know, I'm that kind of person. So I have been able to forgive myself, understanding that this is an illness. So I have been able to make amends, and I have been able to be honest. But I still find living in reality 24/7 tough. You know, it's not easy. But I love my life today. And I never, ever thought I'd be able to say that. I love being married. I'm lucky because I had my work. I didn't meet my husband until I was about 35. And I'd been in recovery for quite a long time. I'd got to know myself. I'd done some work on myself through these rooms. And I was able to meet and fall in love with someone who loved me for me. Whether I was fat or thin or bad-tempered or tricky, and I'm really difficult. And he's a wonderful guy, apart from the fact he supports Arsenal. And I'm a die-hard Chelsea fan. So we've got a real problem in the house at the moment, as we're both probably going to be fighting for that fourth space. But anyway. But he is, you know, we've been together for, I don't know, 18, 19 years. And he really does still love me for me. And I do for him. We give each other a lot of space. As time goes on, even more space. That's very important. You know, at the end of the day, he's usually downstairs watching football, and I'm usually upstairs watching football. But we come together at dinner. It's, you know, it is a nightmare. The only thing he said to me when we got married, he said, you know, Lisa, you can be you, whatever happens, happens, but if we have sons, they have to support Arsenal. And we've got these two fabulous boys who do support Arsenal, and one of them is just so obsessive about this team, so hates my team, it is horrendous. But anyway, they, you know, and that's another thing, I couldn't get pregnant and had to have IVF. So here I was, you know, recovering drug addict, sticking needles into myself to try and get pregnant. And it was a nightmare. And, you know, I miscarried and, you know, became even bigger from all these steroids and all this, you know, IVF stuff, what it does to you. But luckily, being an addict, I wasn't going to give up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the age of 40, I had these two fantastic boys. And they're just, you know, they're 6 foot now, 6 foot one, and just fantastic boys. And being a mum is probably my greatest achievement ever. And I love it. I absolutely love it. It's fearful and frightened. It's, you know, they've got to the point now that, you know, they're 15 going on 19. There's nothing they don't know. Guess where they get that from. You know, drugs, I don't know. At the moment, there's definitely smoking. There's definitely beer, more beer that's allowed. Girls that bring in bottles that I'm sniffing out. You know, where that's going to lead, I don't know. But they know about me, they know about my path, they don't know all the war stories, but, you know, there is... They know enough. And, you know, all I say to them is, and I really hope I'm able to do this, is I'll never judge you. Just bring it home. Whatever it is, those feelings, those thoughts, just hopefully we've made a safe enough environment, because I never felt I could do that. I always felt I was going to be judged, and I never felt good enough. And I just hope. But who knows? I wake up in the morning now, and I really do. I have a very exciting life. I gave up my career. I'm still doing stuff within it, but took a bit of a backseat a few years ago to be a mum, to be more of a hands-on mum. That was very, very frightening. That was about 4 or 5 years ago. You know, I stopped working 24/7, and that was really, really, really scary. But I was so lucky, you know, to have the infrastructure to be able to do that. You know, financially to be able to do that, to have, you know, a husband who was able to support the family and to actually do something that I really wanted to do, which was to be around more for my boys. And to be able to do that, for me, in the end, it was a no-brainer. But I had to do a lot of work on things like, you know, more meditation-type stuff and sitting with myself. I hadn't really sat with myself. There was always the phones going off and the computers and the this and jumping on this thing and running off here and running off there and, you know, wheeling and dealing and da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, I've had a lot more time with me, and that hasn't been easy, but it's been fantastic. I've got a lot more involved in service. I'm a trustee of Action on Addiction, which is quite a big addiction charity. And I'm a trustee of other charities, and I'm involved with helping to, well, it's not set government policy over addiction, I wouldn't call it that, but I'm involved in some think tanks trying to convince people with the keys that methadone is not the answer. And it's a real privilege to be able to do that. And I'm so lucky that I'm proud of where I am, so I can talk about being an addict in recovery. I'm lucky to feel that. I don't know why I feel it, but I do feel it. And I don't really care who knows that. I've got quite involved with schools. In fact, I took this great guy who's been in recovery for a couple of years, goes to meetings, and... he came up and did a talk at my boys' school to the year above my boys, because 4 kids had just been expelled for dope. And it was amazing. I just sat at the back because my boys didn't want me involved. You know, it's too close. you know, it's which I understand. And I listen to this guy talk and do a share, like I'm sharing now, to these 16-year-old kids, and you could have heard a pin drop. It was amazing. And the kids, we then left, and they asked a lot of questions afterwards, which he told me about in the car going back to London. As you can imagine, I was desperate to know exactly what was going on in my boys' school. But anyway, it was just fantastic. And the feedback has been incredible. And I think that's it. I think, you know, I really can today. I do like myself. I do have self-worth, not all the time. And I can give myself a pat on the back for not only turning up, but turning up with a feeling of wanting to put back. Because I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the people in these rooms. And I haven't found it easy. And I would sit here for years, angry, resentful, jealous. I remember the first sponsor I got was, you know, the most attractive, sought-after girl in the room. Because I just wanted to be like her. You know, just, you know, those first few years for me. But I'm, you know, today I do find life a lot easier. The only thing that I'm now finding at the ripe old age of 55 is I'm now, you know, I don't want to die. You know, having taken my life so, you know, and I've done the interferon, and luckily I've got rid of my hep C, but my liver is not good. I have got a cirrhotic liver that has to be checked every 4 or 5 months. You know, and it's not a great thing to have. But I'm sure something else will get me first. But I have got this thing at the moment. You know, I'm not good on planes, not being in control. My poor husband hasn't driven our car for years. I always say, well, you know, that way you can have a drink or whatever. But it's just because I want to be in control. You know, and I do now have a fear of dying, because I love my life today so much. And it's a miracle. You know, I can get up and I can walk around. I can listen to music. I still listen to all the old punk stuff, which is the music I grew up with. You know, Sid Vicious, I Did It My Way. It's still one of my favourite songs, much to my boys' complete. Actually, they like Nirvana, so, you know, their taste is not too bad. Luckily, they're not into all this sort of hip-hop sort of stuff. But, you know, I don't really... I'm trying to think of what else I've got to say. I do sponsor. I don't sponsor a lot because I'm slightly erratic with the steps. And I don't take that lightly. I do believe this is an illness that kills. And thank you. And I know that, yes, it might be many, many years since I picked up that drug or drink. I know that if I stop coming to meetings and if I stop reading, doing things like I read a day by day, you know, a thought for the day thing every morning, which I never remember what it says within seconds of reading it, but I do it, and the fact that I do it, because I know if I was to forget that I'm an addict in recovery, I'd be back out there. And for me to go back out there with so many incredible things that have happened to me and having such amazing people in my life, for me to go back out there, I don't think I'd come back. And I've buried a lot of people, a lot of friends, who have not made it. And I'm just incredibly lucky. One of my sponsees, you know, I was her sponsor for quite a few years. I sat on her husband's right at their wedding. I watched her have these amazing children, and she died last year. Her body was not discovered for about 2 months. She lay next to her husband dead for 2 months in this enormous house with a million rooms. And they'd ended up in this one room that they had taped off so that no one could get to them. With these four children who are all under the age of 16. And it is just, you know, it's the most horrendous illness. And it kills. And it kills often. And if all I have to do is to keep coming back to these rooms and open my mouth and say how I honestly feel, to have the quality of life I have today, for me, it's a no-brainer. You know, it really is. So, thank you for listening. It's a real privilege to be asked to do the share and to be able to sit here and to mean everything that I've said and to really feel that I'm in the right place and that things, as long as I keep it in the day, and that for me is incredibly important. And I say this to my boys, you know, as they're now at that sort of, you know, that age, exams, girls, all that sort of stuff. Just keep it in the day. Get to bed. You know, when I go to bed, it's TVs on and Wi-Fis and chocolates and phones and magazines, and there's hardly any room for my husband. You know, everything and anything, you know, that can take away, you know, that, oh, I love it. I love getting into bed. I'm usually in bed by about 9:30. But that's okay. Anyway, thanks very much for listening.